coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The Reach Riverside Project now has the financing to start the housing portion of its plan, a big step for the ambitious effort to revitalize that Wilmington neighborhood.
Securing the financing means that site preparation work can begin before the end of the year, and by the time spring rolls around, we'll start seeing the first signs of those new homes.
Contributor Larry Nagyes joins us to discuss where the Reach Riverside Project stands and where it's going. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week's Arts Playlist introduces us to a Sussex County teacher using art therapy to help her students. And we have the latest episode of the A Matter of Facts podcast examining fact-checking. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The highly anticipated Reach Riverside Project in the northeast section of Wilmington appears ready to begin in earnest. Contributor Larry Nagengast has been following the project since it was announced in late 2018, and this week he reports it is ready to start turning over dirt and making good on its promise of major revitalization in this portion of Wilmington. Larry details the road to this point and what to expect over the next few years in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to walk us through what's going on. So let's first remind people what Reach Riverside is. What was the vision for it that was articulated 2 years ago when it was announced for that particular area of Wilmington?
Well, Reach Riverside is both an organization and a plan. As an organization, it's the nonprofit entity that describes itself as the community quarterback for the plan of the same name. And that's a massive $250 million project to rebuild and revitalize the Riverside area in northeast Wilmington. REACH, by the way, is an acronym, and it stands for Redevelopment, Education, and Community Health. And those are the key pillars in turning around an area where education levels are much lower and poverty levels are much higher than in the rest of Wilmington.
And the reason we're talking right now is that this project has hit a key milestone. What is that, and what does it mean for the project?
Well, the milestone is that Reach Riverside has just secured the $20 million in financing that's needed to start the first phase of revitalizing the community. And that involves building 74 new townhouses in an area between 27th Street and Todd's Lane. That's just a couple of blocks east of Northeast Boulevard and just up the street from the Kingswood Community Center, which is the hub of most activity in Riverside. Now, securing the financing means that site preparation work can begin before the end of the year, and by the time spring rolls around, we'll start seeing the first signs of those new homes, which should be ready for occupancy in late spring or early summer of 2022, within the next 18 months.
And you noted in your piece that the goal was to get rolling earlier this year. Can you tell us a little about some of the challenges that threw this a bit off track? Obviously, one of them is the pandemic.
Well, yes. As with so many other plans that were in the works for 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic did get in the way. And so there were also some supply chain issues, some complexities in working with the multiple financing sources, and there was also a change in leadership at the Wilmington Housing Authority, which owns much of the land in Riverside and manages virtually all of the aging housing units that will be demolished as the overall plan moves forward. So it was this combination of factors that slowed things down for a couple of months. They had hoped to get started in the spring, but hey, we're already at the end of the year. But still, they are moving forward.
If nothing else, they did hit that 2020 goal by just that much.
Right.
So you did talk a little bit earlier about kind of the overall aspects of this first segment. Let's talk a little bit more specifics. What is this first phase, going to specifically look like? What are they doing in this first phase of the project?
Okay. As I said, 74 new townhomes, and they're going to range from one-bedroom units up to much larger four-bedroom units. They will be energy efficient, so that's going to keep the utility bills down. And the area is also going to have a community room, some green space with a raised garden area, a gazebo, and a tot lot where little kids can play. 12 of the townhouses will be ADA accessible, which means that they will be built to accommodate individuals who have physical disabilities. Now, one of the goals of Reach Riverside is to create a diverse mix of residents in this revitalized community. So of those 74 new units, 59 of them are going to be designated as affordable housing, and that means they will be rented to households with lower incomes, with rents, and they'll be paying rents that are based on their income. The other 15 units are designated as workforce units, which means that they will be rented to households whose earnings are pretty close to the median income for the Wilmington area. Now, the rents haven't been determined yet. That's going to depend upon market conditions and the like, in a year or so from now. But they're telling me that a two-bedroom unit in this workforce portion of the project will probably be leased for somewhere in the neighborhood of $900 a month.
This is a very complex project. It's going to take some time. What comes after that first phase? What's next after that?
Okay. Yeah, well, the master plan calls for building about 600 townhouses in 8 phases. So this is a process that could easily stretch out over a decade. And, if there are any sorts of delays with financing or construction or anything else, it could easily take much more than 10 years for the whole thing to be built out. Now, the first phase is being built on land that is now vacant, but the later phases will be built in portions where there are many old WHA units now standing. So the way this is going to work is that the current WHA residents will get first crack at renting the new townhouses. And then as they move out, the old homes are going to be torn down to make way for the new ones. There's going to be plenty of room for current WHA tenants because 600 new units are going to be going up where there are now roughly 300 homes standing. Now, one other thing worth mentioning about this housing, it's not going to be all rental. As part of the commitment to create a mixed-income community, about 20% of the new housing, roughly 120 units overall, are going to be sold at market rates to buyers who will make their own homes there. So you're going to have a home ownership portion of this community as well.
But as you've noted, this is not just about housing. What are some of the other physical aspects, physical pieces of this project that will be coming along in these next few years?
Okay, well, one of those pieces came into being earlier this year, in fact. That's the warehouse. That's the Community Education, Arts, and Recreation Center for Teenagers. However, the warehouse opened just as the pandemic hit, so it's been operating at very limited capacity, doing a lot of things virtually, and it's not really going to hit its potential until sometime next year when hopefully pandemic clears up. Now, the biggest new piece outside of the housing is going to be construction of a new Kingswood Community Center about a block and a half away from the current building. Kingswood is going to celebrate its 75th anniversary next year, and the old community center is showing its age. The new building will cost about $30 million, and a fundraising campaign to gather up some of those funds is going to be held next year. We're looking at construction starting in 2022 at the earliest, and features of the new community center would include an expanded early learning academy for preschoolers, a larger Jimmy Jenkins Senior Center, large meeting rooms for community events, and office space for organizations that would provide social and health services to local residents, groups like Christiana Care, Delaware State University, the University of Delaware, perhaps even some state agencies or smaller nonprofits. Now, beyond that, they're also looking at strengthening and beautifying that strip of businesses along Northeast Boulevard. You know, the eyesores, all of them might not go away, but they'll definitely get a facelift. And new businesses that meet residents' daily needs, things like grocers, hardware stores, produce stands, things like that may eventually arrive. Finally, we've got the East Side Charter School, which is located at the very northern end of the redevelopment area. Education, as I noted, is a major theme in this project, and the eventual goal at East Side is to add high school grades to what is now a kindergarten through eighth grade program.
And there's also now some programs associated with this as well, one that you feature in your piece, in particular, Empower. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, Empower is yet another acronym, and it stands for Economic Mobility Places Ownership Within Everyone's Reach. Reach Riverside is budgeting $1 million a year for 3 years for this program, and it's going to take a holistic approach to creating economic stability for families in this low-income community. And through Empower, representatives of organizations like Delaware State University, Christiana Care, financial and social services organizations are going to provide an array of services and training programs that would include things like employment coaching, tutoring, job matching and placement, financial coaching, health screenings, health improvement plans, and family support services like emergency food and clothing, child care, and mental health counseling.
You also reported earlier this year on a COVID relief fund that Reach had established. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's worked out so far?
Well, yes. As I mentioned, COVID-19 may have delayed the start of this construction project, but it also drove Reach Riverside leaders into an expansion of other services to provide to residents of the area. The relief fund was the centerpiece of this effort. Now, the organization solicited funds from individuals and groups that have supported the revitalization, and they raised enough money to distribute $285,000 to 244 families who are now living in Wilmington Housing Authority units. The families received $250 a month placed on debit cards issued by M&T Bank for up to 5 months. And now this was a big help for those families in buying things like diapers, cleaning products, and clothing. Now keep in mind, the beneficiaries here were people who were usually unemployed or underemployed, and the relief fund started making distributions before any of that federal emergency funding relating to the pandemic kicked in. Now, in addition to the relief fund, Reach Riverside provided help in several other ways to residents of the community. They handed out free face masks. They arranged COVID-19 testing. They distributed more than 400 laptop computers, and not to mention some household supplies and more than 15,000 free meals.
You've been watching this Reach Riverside project now for 2 years. Does it feel like it has the momentum to really deliver on the promise for Riverside and that community?
Well, in our conversations in the past, I've sometimes quoted some great philosophers, and this time I'm going to call on the great Tug McGraw, whose rallying cry of "You Gotta Believe" carried those otherwise mediocre 1973 New York Mets to the seventh game of the World Series. Now, I'm seeing the momentum build here, but COVID-19 has caused some delays, and keeping a $250 million project on track is going to be a major challenge when we don't know how long the pandemic will prevent the national economy from getting up to speed again. As a point of comparison, however, this is at least a 10-year plan, and Wilmington Mayor Mike Perzycki has often pointed out that the city's riverfront redevelopment has been going on for more than 25 years, and it's still considered by many to be only halfway done. So what I'm saying, I guess, is that there is a need for patience, because if residents expect too much too soon, disappointment may set in. But more important than patience is persistence. If things don't go according to plan or not quite fast enough, the Reach Riverside team, and that includes all residents of the area, will have to be persistent. They must keep pushing ahead. And if they do, they will have a vibrant, exciting neighborhood that they will truly enjoy calling their home. So you just have to remember, you got to believe.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time on The Green this week. His piece updating the Reach Riverside project in Wilmington is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with Arts Playlist, where we meet a Sussex County teacher incorporating art therapy into work with her students. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Sussex Tech High School's most recent Teacher of the Year is melding her graphic design skills with art therapy. Kelly Gerke has taught digital publishing and print design at Sussex Tech since 2012. She says her focus is supporting her students and bringing out their talents and skills, a job that's required some extra creativity since the COVID-19 pandemic started. In this week's Arts Playlist, Gerke chats with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about how she uses art in a therapeutic fashion to help students express themselves and cope with stress and anxiety.
Actually, I started doing art therapy maybe 2 to 3 years ago, and by that I mean I just started weaving different lessons into my lesson plans where I found out more about the individual student. I had realized I'm lucky enough that I have students for 4 years. So they come to me as freshmen, and then they leave as seniors. And sometimes I'd have some very quiet students that didn't really open up to me until they were in 10th and 11th grade after having them a couple years. And I realized that if I wrote lesson plans to find out about the individuals when they were freshmen, they would open up through their art. They may not open up through speaking or necessarily writing about themselves, but visually, the things that they would draw, a lot of self-portraits I do, I would learn things about the student, and then I would learn about things such as they had anxiety or they were nervous to be in school or maybe they didn't have the best situation going on at home. And from that, I'm able to help them much better be successful people.
Yeah, absolutely. As the district's Teacher of the Year, your platform is about using art in a therapeutic fashion, as you just said, to help students express themselves, cope with stress, anxiety. This is especially important while students deal with COVID-19 pressures, right?
Yes, definitely. Actually, just a couple weeks ago, my junior said, could we please have an art therapy lesson, Mrs. Gerke? And I said, sure. So I used typography because I teach graphic design. So I took the idea of letters and how you need to understand how different fonts express different feelings. And they just were able to write a stream of consciousness about, you know, how they were feeling. And then they used different types of letters to express the words that would express their emotions, basically. So it really helps them get out some of the frustrations that they're dealing with. And so many of the kids are just so frustrated right now, not being able to socialize with their friends and trying to do learning online or in person, because we do both, actually. We do reverse field trips. So occasionally I get to have small groups of kids in. But the whole thing is frustrating.
Yeah, talk about how you get through to your students in this time of COVID and deal with graphic design skills and art therapy in this time of COVID-19 when much of it is done virtually. Give me some other sample lessons that you do with them.
Well, you have to be creative. I think all teachers right now have to be creative because we're trying to teach the kids the best way that we can with what we have to teach. So, for instance, my 10th graders, I'm just teaching them the skills that they need to become graphic designers. So this summer, I spent the summer basically making sure they all had computer access, and then I had to make sure they all had software access, and then I had to make sure that all of the access worked, and then they had internet. So that alone is a giant process. But now that we're that far, what we do is we do a Zoom, and I teach them a certain concept. So, for instance, yesterday, my 10th graders, I was teaching them how to create a gradient in Adobe Illustrator, which is a drawing program that I teach. So I would demonstrate how to do the tool, and then I would have the kids get off of, you know, the Zoom for a second to go to their software, and then they would demonstrate the tool. Then they would each flip their screen so I could see the screens, and then we'd talk over any problems that they had while they were trying to complete the process, basically.
What has the feedback been from your students?
As far as how lessons are going?
Yes.
I feel like it depends on the class. Every human being is different, obviously, and you get certain classes that understand one way of teaching and certain classes that understand another way of teaching and certain individuals in each class, you know, that understand it better than others. So I feel like two of my classes really are grasping the concept and they really like teaching that way, where one of my other classes, they're more vocal and they're more fine artists and they like to draw more. So I'm trying to tie more of the fine art in with the computer art for their class because I just think it's helping them learn a little better than they would if we were just doing computer art.
We want to remind everyone we're talking with the Teacher of the Year for Sussex Tech. Her name is Kelly Gerke, and Kelly is a digital publishing and print design teacher at Sussex Tech. We're talking to her because she melds graphic design skills with art therapy. Kelly, is art healing?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I have student after student after student who have left my program, who I still keep in touch with, and so many of them were not able to express it when they were actually here, and they will tell you that just being able to have my class to come in and be able to be creative and express themselves through art, some of them, that's what kept them in high school. So it's amazing how, I mean, I have so many kids with different learning disabilities. I have a lot of kids who deal with anxiety, and it's just a way for them to get all of those feelings out on paper or through different mediums, you know, through painting, through collage. And I definitely know for sure that art is healing in the process.
Why do you think it's so healing and works so well for people, for students in this case, for students who have disabilities or anxiety issues?
I think because a lot of it is tangible. They can touch something. They're not just having to sit still and listen. And most teachers don't do that, by the way. I don't mean to say that, you know, a regular English teacher or a math teacher just lectures, because of course we're all much more creative than that nowadays. But I do think there's something about just taking your pencil and putting it on a piece of paper and just drawing whatever is on your mind that helps relieve stress and anxiety.
All right. As a print design teacher, what would your advice be for a new student exploring the graphic design field?
Yes, I would probably say, you know, bring your imagination and be willing to keep an open mind. And if you don't always grasp a concept right away, that's fine. I mean, anything that's hard to do in life is worth doing because you're going to learn something from it. So sometimes the software seems like a lot when we're learning a different process. And the kids will want to compare their work to, you know, their neighbor's work. And they can't do that because it all just takes time. And if you keep trusting the process and practicing, then you're going to get better and you're going to become a great designer.
What's your background?
I originally was a graphic designer. I worked for Maverick Marketing in Lewis, Delaware, and then I worked for Group J Design. For Jean-Carla Churchman, who's an amazing graphic designer, if anyone knows her. And I was working there one day, and someone from the school approached us and said that they needed a teacher to fill in for a couple weeks. So I said, oh, sure, I'll do that. That sounds like fun. And then 2 weeks became a month, and then we found out the other teacher was not able to come back, unfortunately, and I had to decide if I wanted to be a teacher. But I knew the day that I walked in this door that this was the place for me. There's nothing more rewarding or fulfilling than being able to teach something that I love to students. And it's amazing. It's amazing. Some of the kids come in ninth grade and they don't even know, you know, how to turn the computer on. And to see them leave as seniors with all of these amazing art skills and these portfolios that they can use to get jobs is really is the best feeling in the world.
You've been at Sussex Tech since 2012. Have any of your students gone on to greatness?
Oh, my gosh. So many of them. there's so many that I can't even. So one of them was lucky enough to, he's a costume designer, and he was able to work on Lady Gaga's piano.
No.
Yes, the one where she had feathers all over the piano. So that's one of my favorite stories. Another one is he's head of marketing for an environmental company, very much into the environment. I mean, I have students all over the place that are working in the creative field doing amazing things. So,
what would your advice be to any of your students right now who said, hey, Miss Gerke, I want to go on to do this or to do that? What would your main advice be to them?
I would say that it's a competitive field. The artistic field is competitive, but it is so booming right now because really we live in a digital world right now. So people need someone who understands the software and how to create different pieces, whether it be pieces for print, pieces for a website. I don't necessarily do multimedia design, which is also another big artistic degree that you can get right now. But if you work hard, there's jobs out there, and you can live your best life by being creative and having an amazing career.
Thanks to Sussex Tech High School's Teacher of the Year, Kelly Gerke, and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with the latest episode of the Delaware Humanities A Matter of Facts podcast. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the latest installment of the Delaware Humanities podcast, A Matter of Facts. The podcast delves into identifying trustworthy and reliable sources of news and information as part of Delaware Humanities' mission to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. This season, the podcast more closely examines popular sources of news and information. And this episode is focused on fact-checking. There are now a variety of fact-checking websites available, such as Snopes and PolitiFact, as well as fact-checking done by various media outlets. But how did fact-checking get started, and what role does it play in helping people navigate the information they see daily in the news and on social media? To help us better understand fact-checking, Dr. Danigel Young joins the podcast. She is an associate professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware and distinguished research fellow with the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. She studies political satire, political media effects, the psychology of political humor, and the intersection of entertainment and information. She also spent time specifically examining fact-checking. Here is this latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. Well, I feel like a discussion about fact-checking would have been one kind of conversation, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago, and now is something completely different. Is it possible to quantify the impact that the Trump presidency and this increased polarization in our country has had on fact-checking?
That is a great observation. And I would say that there are a couple of factors at play that have shifted sort of the job of fact-checkers and the nature of the pursuit of fact-checking. One is the Trump presidency. However, you know, many of us in political communication see Trump's style of rhetoric as more of a symptom than as a causal agent in itself. There are other factors that are larger in terms of shaping public discourse. As you mentioned, political polarization, which has been on the rise, you know, especially since the 90s. Now, political polarization, we can talk about two different things. One is the notion that the average position, platform position, of Democrats has moved slightly left, while the average position of Republicans has moved to the right. What is more consequential in terms of our information space is the accompanying affective polarization, which means that starting at the level of elites and more now at the level of the citizenry, Democrats do not like Republicans and Republicans do not like Democrats. And so there's this affective or emotional dimension to it that really shapes how people respond to anything that comes out of the mouth or the fingertips of someone on the other side of the aisle. I will add to that the changing media landscape where decentralized control over our information space through the internet and social media, where there are not those same sort of gatekeepers and professionalized individuals who determine, you know, what they play the role of arbiter of truth, right? What is true and what is not.
Right.
That role has shifted so much that now with the internet, everyone becomes their own gatekeeper. So all of these situations have sort of come together, including a lack of trust in government institutions, lack of trust in media, all of which contribute to this larger sort of infodemic, as we might call it.
So I want to delve into a number of those things that you mentioned. But before we do that, I do want to take a step back and just talk a little bit about one thing that you did look at in your research into fact-checking, that is its history. And just tell us a little bit, if you can, just a thumbnail sketch perhaps of how fact-checking got started and what did it initially look like in its kind of original form?
Yeah, so really when we're thinking about fact-checking as a sort of separate industry, right, like as a pursuit, because journalism in and of itself is fact-checking, right? So journalists should be in there kind of calling out what is true and what is not. But through the 1980s, there was this sense that we were in this sea of he said, she said journalism that was coming about, where you would have two competing claims that were being made by politicians, and a lot of reports in the news would sort of give airtime to both views. So there was this perception that we need to be able to engage in some kind of check on what is empirically true and what is empirically false. This was especially true coming out of the 1988 presidential campaign between George Bush Sr. and Michael Dukakis, where a lot of the Republican ads were sort of pushing the envelope in terms of advancing falsehoods and, you know, information that you might not call a lie, but that was deliberately misleading. And so some of the folks who were at the helm here looking at this were Kathleen Hall Jamieson from the Annenberg Public Policy Center, who had been studying political ads at the time, and she advocated putting together something that was like an ad watch, where perhaps television news journalists could talk about the claims that were being made in political ads, but do so in a way that didn't reinforce the false claims themselves. And that still today is the biggest conundrum with dealing with lies from elites, is how do you cover those claims, correct them, without reinforcing them in the process? So Jamieson had suggested this visual trick where you put a little sort of a television within the television to basically show that we are currently examining a political ad that you may have seen on TV. We're not rebroadcasting it in its entirety. We're just putting it here to be able to pull it apart and check the claims within it. Some of her pursuits later morphed into a project that she launched with Brooks Jackson, that is factcheck.org, which still is in the business today, along with many other nonpartisan fact-checking organizations. And their work has become very challenging.
I was going to say, I mean, before we kind of get into the challenges that have arisen, how effective was that model back then in the late 80s into the 90s before we kind of reach what we'll talk about next is this more digital internet age?
So the sense was that it did provide viewers with an opportunity to have the corrective information, as we call it. And what we find, generally speaking, I'm trying to, like, because there's so much research on this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to boil it down. Where we find that there are benefits to citizens is with specific empirical claims. If you show someone corrective information and you make sure that you tell what is true, then say, here's the false thing, and then once again, tell what is true. And if you're doing it in the context of something that is tangible and specific, policy details, statistics, numbers, things like that, you really do find a little bit of movement on those underlying beliefs and the knowledge.
So that's kind of like what people have called that's what people kind of call like the sandwich model, right? Where you do truth, falsehood, truth, and you kind of put it together in a sandwich for people.
Exactly. And Jay Rosen from NYU has been doing a great job sort of talking about this as a really easy, straightforward tactic that avoids some of the pitfalls of other methods, which you might have great intentions and you might be trying to fact check something, but you could inadvertently reinforce the false claim just by virtue of the fact that you're not adequately sandwiching it between the two truth pieces of bread. So when we're talking about those really tangible claims, you can understand how, yeah, it would be easy then to correct that and say, you know what, no, the tax cut is not this amount, it's this amount. It doesn't go to this destination, it goes to that destination. Where we do not find a lot of movement is in how those corrected facts or those now updated beliefs then go on to update our overall evaluations of candidates. That's something that we've just been racking our brains about, because you can correct information, but that's not necessarily going to change how people think about candidates or about, you know, global policy. So, and where a lot of this research is heading is to this idea that perhaps what we really need to be thinking about is about our social identity, that people do not process the world like computers, where they get information and then they update their algorithm based on that information, and now they have a changed view of the world. We are not hyper-rational like that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we are incentivized to be social animals, to think of ourselves as members of groups. Now, because polarization is so strong and because partisan identity is so strong, those groups right now are largely Democrat, Republican. So what happens is you might find that you are able to update someone's tangible information about an issue, and you're like, oh, great, okay, so now they're going to have a, quote, corrected attitude towards the candidate. No, they won't. They'll just say, well, okay, so this one thing isn't true, but it might as well be true. We find that a lot. The idea that, like, okay, now an individual has, they recognize the information is false, but they then discount that and they continue to either love their guy or hate the other guy or girl. And that has been a real stumbling block.
I guess that kind of brings us to some of the challenges you're talking about, specifically the challenges of this digital era, the internet, social media. I imagine that kind of plays into that social piece, right? The tribalization piece of this, that people are in their little groups, and it's very easy on the internet, on social media, to stay in that group, right?
100%. Now, what you're talking about here is a concept of echo chambers, right? The notion that people seek out information that supports what they already believe, and they avoid information that, you know, challenges their beliefs. What we have found is that, you know, when I say we, I mean my discipline. I'm not doing all of this. In fact, there's a lot of people who are doing this. Echo chambers do not exist to the extent that we thought they would. So even in online spaces, even in social media, people are actually consuming some pieces of information that, you know, contradict their own viewpoint. Now, that being said, there are individuals for whom, like Facebook groups, like-minded groups of people on issues like, I don't know, these anti-vaccination movements. If you go into a Facebook group that's an anti-vaccination Facebook group where everyone there shares your view, you are going to have a cultivated information ecosystem that is never going to challenge you. It's going to constantly reinforce your beliefs on that issue. And more importantly, it's going to give you a group of friends, a social group of people that you like and that you respect and that you want to share views with and share behaviors with. So for certain, in these certain enclaves, we cannot rule out the possibility that these dynamics are problematic. But for the majority of the public, right, for that big sort of group of us kind of in the middle, we still, no matter what, we still are exposed to information that contradicts our own pre-existing view.
So is there a way for fact checkers, fact-checking sites to attack that? Obviously, probably not very easily, but is there any opening for them to make inroads in those type of situations?
Well, if what we're talking about is really more about the social dynamics and wanting to be part of a group and wanting to sort of feel respected and liked and have status, it's a whole different calculus in terms of how we would engage in correcting those misperceptions, right? Because now it's not like if we just educate people on the factual matters of the day, they will update their views. It doesn't work like that. Instead, this is why social psychologists are, I want to say they're excited by this work, and I don't mean that they think it's a good thing. I mean that there's opportunities here to integrate a lot of very cool social psychological theories, because it's not just about the information. It's about people. It's about relationships. So in terms of where this research is going, it's going into this direction of understanding that we need individuals with competing views to be able to create inroads, relationships, trusting relationships, to be able to garner the trust of individuals and ask questions about why, you know, why is it that you want to think that this is true when it seems that this evidence suggests it's not? You know, are there reasons why? Does it make you feel good to have that? Like, I understand because there are some things that I hold that are untrue, but it makes me feel good to believe they might be true. You know, so vulnerability and empathy and inroads, and most of all, the recognition that correctives really do need to come from trusted, loved friends, family, and network members, not from a clip on the internet or on television.
There's one other challenge, I guess, in this digital age that I wanted to bring up, and that is just the sheer volume of information, including misinformation, disinformation, alternative facts, fake news, whatever you want to call it. Is it difficult for fact-checking just to keep up anymore? And do people just become kind of numb to fact-checking when there's just this much of it needing to be done because there's this much information out there?
Yes and yes. I don't know if you want more to that.
Well, if you want to elaborate a little bit.
It is. There is so much. There is. It's just a fire hose of noise. And so, you know, if you start thinking about it like, okay, fact checkers, we need to police every claim on the internet. That's never going to happen. That's never going to work. One thing that I think that we've recognized over the last few years is that the role of mainstream journalists in calling out things that are false and reminding people of things that are true is paramount. Because while people do go on the internet and read all kinds of stuff, in terms of trusted sources, when you're talking about the legacy newspapers, when you're talking about major networks, there's still a lot more trust in those media outlets. So there's a role to be played there in amplifying truth and calling out lies. Lies or simply misinformation, right? There's also a possibility when you think about when you talked about, are people just sort of getting numb to this? I think that's absolutely true. And that is where that social dimension then becomes paramount. Because if there really just is this fire hose of misinformation out there, we're not consuming everything and we're not engaging with everything. Not everything is landing on a radar. So if we can find ways to encourage people to, you know, augment and amplify the information that is true within their trusted social networks, you know, there could be inroads there that would combat that sort of sense that we're just drowning in chaos.
I do want to pick up one thing you talked about, and that is what we call these things when we are doing the fact checking. Does it matter if we call them lies or misleading or false claims or unsubstantiated claims? Because we've heard a lot of discussion about that where, well, why doesn't the media just call that a lie? Does that make a difference, do you think?
Yes. And I share this frustration as a citizen, but as someone who studies this, I do understand why journalists are reluctant to call things lies. Okay. Because as a citizen, you're looking at this and you're like, okay, here is this politician or elite who has said something that is untrue, and we know that they've done the political calculus, and that is why they're saying this thing that is not true, and we know that they know it's not true. Well, do I really know? As a citizen, I'm assuming this, right? But if you are a journalist and you have to really stand by your words, Are you ever going to be able to get in Donald Trump's mind to understand whether or not he believes the things he says? Right? Like, I would not want to make that wager. I wouldn't want to try to be a psychotherapist for an elite individual to try to understand if they truly believe the things they're saying. If they believe it, technically, it does not constitute a lie. It constitutes a falsehood, right? And that's when we talk about misinformation. Disinformation is information that has been deliberately designed to deceive. So if you cannot prove that the source of that information is doing it deliberately and strategically to deceive, you can't call it disinformation. You call it misinformation. And those are sort of the semantics surrounding this issue.
Which, of course, can be very frustrating for, as you said, the average person. I'm also curious, and I guess we've talked a little bit about this, but I guess I want to just ask, you know, in a little more focused way, you know, how much do you feel that fact-checking in some ways, I mean, it almost plays into our polarized nation? I mean, does the potential for someone to take a fact check and say, aha, you're lying, right, serve as fuel perhaps even for that polarization?
Yeah, that is a great point. There are several scholars who have studied this, sort of the question about, is polarization really enhanced when people fact check other people? And who is doing that? Who is sending someone that email that says, hey, just so you know, this has been shown to be untrue, and here's the link to factcheck.org. Well, where it gets really tricky is, especially if you're in a public space, like online, if you're on Facebook and somebody posts something and then you say something in reply publicly and say, hey, this is not true, see here. Well, now what you've done is, you have violated that person's ability to sort of save face because you've called them out publicly. And now the inclination as a threatened animal individual, is to double down and be angry. So you got to think, what is your long game here? Is your long game to actually get the person to update their belief system and to see the issue accurately? Or are you just playing a status game where you're trying to prove that you're better than that person? If you're just trying to prove you're better than them and you don't care that they get mad and double down, okay, go ahead, publicly call them out, right? But that's not going to help us in terms of the health of democracy. What might help is a private text message to that person, a private email that says, hey, just, you know, love catching up with you on Facebook. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about this thing that you shared. Don't want to put it out there publicly, you know, but here's some, you know, information that you might want to take a look at. Now, is that going to update their view? It has a higher likelihood of getting them to reconsider their beliefs than calling them out and shaming them and embarrassing them.
We'd like to end this podcast by asking each of our guests the same question, and that is, where do you get your news on a daily basis? What are your favorite news sources? Where do you go to get the facts that you're looking for?
Yeah, well, I'm the boring person who is, you know, I stick with my legacy media. So I have subscriptions to the Washington Post and the New York Times, and I'm a supporting member of my NPR station. I'm up outside of Philly, so I'm a WHYY supporter. And those are my go-to all the time. I'm also on Twitter, where I follow a lot of journalists. And I enjoy that because they are not just sharing the stories they've written, but also the sort of behind-the-scenes thoughts about those stories. I think that it can be really overwhelming for folks to think about where they should be consuming news. I would encourage people to find sources that they really enjoy and that they can look forward to. I also will listen to the New York Times Daily podcast on my morning walk with my dog. And, you know, find those sources that are trustworthy and credible sources. The legacy outlets are great. And those that you can really look forward to.
Dr. Danegal Young, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Delaware and Distinguished Research Fellow with the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us on this edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast.
Thank you so much, Tom.
You've been listening to the latest edition of the A Matter of Facts podcast. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. A Matter of Facts is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Its mission is to engage, educate, and inspire all Delawareans through cultural programming. We thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation for its generous support of this initiative and the Pulitzer Prizes for its partnership. A Matter of Facts is produced by Delaware Public Media. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, Sierra Fisher and Kyle Parks with Delaware Humanities, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Pern saying thanks for joining us this week. The Green is taking a holiday break over the next 2 weeks. We hope you enjoy your holidays, and we'll see you again next on Friday, January 8th, here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.